This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that we've seen the president's grand jury testimony, the biggest question facing the country is, has he committed an impeachable offense? My guest, Lawrence Tribe, is a constitutional lawyer and a professor at Harvard Law School. He's the author of American Constitutional Law. The third edition will soon be published. I spoke with Tribe earlier today about the president's testimony and what happens next. You know, the president has taken a lot of heat for parsing words, particularly in using the definition of sex that was given to him in the Paula Jones case. Let me just read that definition. It says, for the purposes of this deposition, a person engages in sexual relations when the person knowingly engages in or causes contact with the genitalia, anus, groin, breast, inner thigh, or buttocks of any person with an intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person. Contact means intentional touching, either directly or through clothing. Clinton seems to have definitely found the loopholes in this definition. Is this a good definition of sex? Do you think anyone will ever use this definition again?
Well, if anyone ever really used it before, I certainly think they won't use it again. It was part of a three-part definition, the other parts of which were designed to deal with things like one-way oral sex, I suppose. But this language, taken literally, quite clearly didn't cover what the president says he was doing or implies he was doing, assuming that he sort of was in a situation where he could say, look, Ma, no hands. I mean, that's, of course, what people, I think, doubt. They don't necessarily doubt that it was okay for him to use this peculiar definition because he didn't make it up. I mean, it was a definition that was perhaps unintentionally given to him by the judge who, in the course of her rulings, struck out parts 2 and 3 of a three-part definition that had in the past been used in the context of sex harassment cases. And having struck out parts 2 and 3, she was left with this rather peculiar definition, which the president quite rightly said he didn't violate, if you believe him rather than Monica Lewinsky, about whether he did or didn't fondle and touch her in various places while she was giving him oral sex. Now, most people think, even without hearing her testimony, that it would be inherently unbelievable that he would have remained that passive. But given her testimony, it becomes a he said, she said proposition.
Which means what?
Well, it basically means if you believe her, he touched her in certain places, therefore was lying when he said that he did not engage in sexual relations, even according to the narrower definition, and was lying deliberately and intentionally, perhaps not on a matter that was material to the Jones trial, and therefore perhaps not committing perjury in that case, but to the extent that he reaffirmed that proposition before the grand jury, it would be the more serious offense of perjury before the grand jury. Now, all of that has to do only with the scenario we would have before us if, after the president leaves office, he is indicted for perjury, which he may well be. That's quite separate from the issue that now confronts the Congress and the country, namely the issue of whether he has committed offenses that would warrant his impeachment by the House of Representatives and his conviction and removal from office by the Senate. It would be very odd, I think, for that large question of state, whether the President of the United States should be removed from office forcibly, it would be very odd for that question to turn on the niceties of whether, when he was on the receiving end of oral sex, the president did or did not touch Monica Lewinsky's breast. It's so hard to imagine that the future of the republic and the profoundly important precedent about the power of the presidency and the ability of the Congress to remove the president, very hard to imagine that it should turn on that.
I have another question, a kind of bizarre question perhaps, about this definition of sex that was used in the Paula Jones case. It said, you know, that sex is when any person touches genitals, et cetera,
yes, the big six, some people have called them.
But with an intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person. Now, does that any person include the person who's being deposed? In other words, if the person is touching another person
for his or her
for his own
self-gratification,
they couldn't care less if the other person is gratified or not.
That's right. I think,
does that count as sex?
Well,
according to this definition.
Good hypothetical question. I think that probably it was not intended to mean that. I think it was intended to refer not to the gratification of the toucher, but to the gratification of the touchee. But in this case, thankfully, nothing seems to turn on that distinction.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lawrence Tribe. He's a constitutional lawyer and a professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. The president has taken a lot of heat for quote, parsing words. As a lawyer in a court of law, is that what's done all the time? Parsing words?
Well, in certain contexts. I mean, if you're involved in a case dealing with a very intricate statutory scheme under the securities laws or the tax laws, you engage certainly in a rather fine-grained dissection of the language. And in fact, even in the more grandiose context of constitutional law, part of what one does is to parse the text and to look at its precise terms and at the syntax and the structure to see exactly what is meant. In a context, however, where the general sense of things counts more than anything narrowly technical, the parsing of words can sometimes backfire. And I think in the grand jury testimony we heard, at two points or three, the president was his own worst enemy, not because what he was saying really represented any attitude dangerous or harmful to the public, but because it sounded so legalistic and almost like the embodiment of sophistry. When, in a soundbite that I'm sure will be heard over and over and over again for the next 100 years, he said, "It all depends on what the meaning of is. He actually had a simple point that he was making, and he could have made it, you know, by saying that there's a difference between saying there is a relationship going on and saying there was at one point a relationship going on. But instead, perhaps not able to resist his own intelligence, he put it in this other way, and it really sounded as though he was dancing alone on the head of a pin. And likewise, when it came to the question of whether he was alone, speaking of dancing alone, when he was alone in the Oval Office with Monica Lewinsky, he looked at the camera and at one point, I think, said, well, it depends on what you mean by alone. And since most people think that without elaboration, they know what alone means, and since it's obvious in the end that he was not trying to deny that the activities that he and Monica Lewinsky were engaging in were not part of some exhibitionist operation, it would have been a lot better, I think, for him not to seem to draw those lines. But I think he was in the thrall of his lawyers, whom I think have not always served him well. That is, focusing rather obsessively on avoiding saying anything that might amount to a confession that he had lied under oath in his deposition. He made a number of statements in the grand jury with that protective purpose in mind, hurting him in the immediate context and not, in the end, providing any real long-run protection. Because if, when he leaves office, he is indicted for perjury either before the grand jury or in the deposition, it's not going to be a defense that he managed to walk the narrow line between the landmines when he was on national television.
My guest is constitutional lawyer Lawrence Tribe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lawrence Tribe, professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. What is the accountability of a special prosecutor?
Almost none, which is one of the reasons that Justice Scalia, dissenting in 1988 from the court's decision upholding the independent counsel law, believed that it was unconstitutional. The independent counsel has a potentially limitless budget, as we have seen, cannot be supervised or directed on a day-to-day basis by his or her supposed superior, the Attorney General of the United States, can be removed only for cause, which means basically for breaking the law in some provable way, and therefore is very much like a loose cannon. And the only thing that enabled that law to survive constitutional attack in 1988 was the argument that the independent counsel was what the Constitution calls an inferior officer, which is not meant as an insult, but it's a description of those officers that may be appointed pursuant to an act of Congress by judges, for example, rather than in the normal way, which would be by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, to treat someone with, to answer your question, virtually no accountability, and with a boundless budget, and with the power to bring down a president as an inferior officer, is sort of a bad joke. And so on the very theory that the court in 1988 invoked to uphold the independent counsel law, I would think a good argument could be made today, though I don't think it's too likely that you would get 5 out of 9 votes in the Supreme Court to uphold the argument, that is, that the independent counsel law, because of this enormous unaccountability, is unconstitutional, though it could be fixed by having the independent counsel selected by the president with the Senate's consent, which, of course, would be itself an absurdity, especially when the independent counsel is supposed to be investigating the president.
Now, if Congress thinks that an offense is potentially impeachable, are they obliged to go forward with impeachment proceedings, or are they expected to use a measure of discretion in deciding whether the impeachment proceedings are worth the time and energy that it will take in the nation?
I think it's a very good question, and it's one on which people have been mistaken in the recent past. A number of people have argued that the House of Representatives has a constitutional obligation, if it finds an impeachable offense, to go forward. There is no basis whatever for that. Nothing in the history supports it. Nothing in past practice, because it's been assumed that the House of Representatives, rather like a prosecutor, can decide that something is not worth prosecuting, that it would do more harm than good. And in fact, the text of the Constitution, by a kind of negative implication, implies the opposite, because Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution has the one mandate in this area. It says that upon conviction, that is conviction in the Senate, of treason, bribery, or another high crime or misdemeanor, the convicted official shall be removed from office. At that point, there's no discretion. But there is no comparable requirement that the person shall be impeached if he or she has committed treason, bribery, or another high crime or misdemeanor. And the absence of any comparable mandate there, I think, speaks volumes. It's Sherlock Holmes' dog that didn't bark. That, in turn, means that this is really an exercise in statecraft and wisdom. That is, the question before the House should not be confused with some technical issue of whether, in terms of this at least somewhat elastic category of high crimes or misdemeanors, perjury about sex before a grand jury does or doesn't cross the line. The question should rather be, first, is it even plausible that it crosses the line into the impeachable zone? If not, it's all over, except maybe censure or something. Second, even if it's in that gray area, since it's not within the hard core of offenses that really go at the very core of democracy and undermine our system of government, but rather in the gray area, would the harm to the country of a protracted, partisan, poisonous impeachment process be worth it just in order to cut short the president's term, given the fact that after his term he will be amenable to criminal punishment for perjury anyway? Now, that is not a question that sort of answers itself, But that's the question that I think the House should put after deciding whether this is even potentially impeachable.
Now, if impeachment hearings don't go forward, but the president is later accused of perjury in the Paula Jones case and is tried for that separately, and that's a possibility, yes?
Yes, certainly.
What charges could he face? What could the consequences be for that?
I think the federal statute for perjury has a 5-year sentence, if I'm not mistaken, and I think that that's pretty inflexible. The federal sentencing guidelines are now such that there isn't that much discretion in sentencing, and it certainly wouldn't matter that it was perjury only about sex. I think it really should be stressed, by the way, as you ask the question about his facing criminal punishment. Some people, I think, believe that somehow we have to go forward with the impeachment process, even if the Constitution doesn't really mandate it, because that's the only way to vindicate the rule of law and to get the president to face the music. And I'm sure they don't mean hail to the chief. I think that's a big mistake. I mean, it is it's the case that if the president, who has already been punished more severely for perjury if he committed it, probably than anyone in history, if the president serves out his term, the independent counsel has a good bit of time after the end of that term still to bring these criminal charges and hold Bill Clinton accountable if he did indeed commit perjury, as that term is technically defined. So he will have to sort of pay the piper for whatever he did wrong. Now, it may be that people think, whether it's 5 years or some other standard criminal sentence, that the only punishment that will really fit the crime here is removing him from office. That, I should stress, though, would represent a perversion of the constitutional process, because it is not the process of impeachment and removal to punish the wrongdoer. That's exactly why the Constitution specifically says that even if you're impeached and removed from office, you can still be criminally prosecuted. That would be double jeopardy if the first process had been deemed punishment.
So the purpose isn't to punish the president, it's to save us.
Exactly, exactly.
To save our Constitution.
To save us and our Constitution, and that's exactly why the question I think we should be asking ourselves is not what should our country do to Bill Clinton, but what would impeachment and removal do to our country? And I think the answer to that depends on what the process looks like. That is, I can imagine, in theory, but not really in reality, designing a process that would be relatively swift so that the nation wouldn't be bogged down indefinitely in all of this, that would be more bipartisan than anything we have seen so far in this matter and are likely to see, that would seem fair and whose results could be more or less accepted no matter which way it came out. If we had that kind of process, then it might make sense to cleanse the body politic by carrying it through to conclusion. What instead we have, if what's happened thus far in the House Judiciary Committee in releasing the report without even having a frame of reference in which to put it, is any indication, is a highly partisan, probably protracted, quite poisonous process of not cleansing the body politic, but polluting it, in which any result I can imagine, either the president's narrow vindication in the Senate or the president's removal from office, would be unacceptable to a large sector of the population, leaving the nation more divided than before, more cynical, with a decades-long legacy of wounds. It seems to me, if I'm right about that, that's a good reason not to go that route and to look instead for other and rather more compact ways of extricating ourselves from the current situation.
Well, Lawrence Tribe, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lawrence Tribe is a professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School.